everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, your fortnightly dose of cultural anarchy. I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by Graham and Rob.
Hello.
Hello.
But not just by us this week.
I mean, well synchronized. Yes, we've got a brand new co-host this week. Introduce yourself.
Hiya, I'm Sarah.
That'll do.
It's short, it's to the point, it's informative.
As long as people have a name to put, like, the strange voices yelling in their heads, it's all good. So, Sarah, where exactly
Andrew.
Do you think your life went wrong?
Let me take you back in time.
Well, if we've got a new person, we're going to have to show them the ropes. And round here, in this manner, we start with a bit of Game of Thrones news.
Ah, yes, solid
that's
beginning.
Right. It's Game of Thrones watch. It's so humid in this room.
See, if the actual theme tune broke off and said that, I would watch that show every week.
What I love about Andrew's Game of Thrones tune is that you might think he's trying to create a music bed, listeners, but he actually gets very angry if any of us talk over it.
He takes pride in his work, man.
I do. Look, I know what the people listen to this show for, and it's definitely, for me, very out of key singing some of the Game of Thrones theme tune before I get bored and stop.
Yes, bit of Game of Thrones news. And you might be expecting, listeners, that it's news of George R. R. Martin finishing a new novel, but amazingly, not.
I mean, they better not be if they've listened to this show before.
Or if they've been keeping up with any of the Game of Thrones news. They know that. I mean, we already established that Ger Martin is doing everything but his job.
We already established that he hasn't turned in the manuscript for The Winds of Winter because he likes sitting on it and he's just worn a comfortable groove into it.
Do you think his editors are a bit like, you know, parents who were trying to figure out what just happened to their expensive vase and they're asking their, you know, 5-year-old George, you know, and saying, did you do it, George? He's like, I was off there doing this and I was playing with the mud and I was feeding donkeys to the dog and, you know, just coming up with lots of
this bigger boy who came around and stole your manuscript, George.
George, have you done your manuscript? The dog ate it.
This week's Game of Thrones watch does not actually involve George R. R. Martin doing anything, which for George R. R. Martin makes it the perfect story.
Wow.
We finally condensed it down into its perfect form.
No, this concerns Kimberly Rico, an inmate at the Maryland Correctional Institute for Women, who has just penned an article for the Marshall Project about books that are not allowed in prison. Not just books, actually. Pictures of alcohol, greetings cards, and a seed.
Greetings cards?
Apparently.
I'm more confused about the pictures of alcohol. I mean, I can understand alcohol. I just can't understand pictures of alcohol.
Sorry, maybe they're both triggers. Maybe like the pictures of alcohol and greetings cards sort of trigger the inmates to remember what's on the outside and it makes their stay more difficult.
Or they just get psychosomatically drunk.
Or what the other inmates do is they stick a bunch of pictures of the alcohol and the greetings cards on the wall. And then when another inmate walks past, they go, oh, wow, it's an alcohol and greeting card store emporium. My one place. And then they kind of run into the shop only to slam their heads into the wall.
Yeah,
I think that's the most likely explanation.
But what's this got to do with Game of Thrones, you might think? Well, Game of Thrones has been banned from the Maryland Correctional Institute for Women because any book with a map in is considered a potential escape tool.
Sorry. Just
to wind that back a little.
Yeah. So any book with a map in, so say the Fellowship of the Ring with a map of Mordor.
Or Enid Blyton with a map of somewhere in the faraway tree land.
Yeah, exactly. The Chronicles of Narnia with a map of Narnia. I don't know.
Treasure Island.
Yeah. The Cosmic Trilogy with a map of the universe.
That's a good point. Does Carl Sagan get this kind of shabby treatment?
Yeah. How does this work? You got a map of Westeros. How are you going to use that to escape from prison?
All right, lads, we tunnel out and we'll come out in the Vale. Then all we need to do is make our way down to King's Landing.
No. We need to nick a boat to the Iron Islands. And then we can be pirates.
Oh, what prisoner doesn't dream of a pirate-themed escape? The best kind.
But if they're pirates from the Iron Islands, wouldn't they then be Iron Pirates?
Oh, and that sounds like Iron Pirates.
Yeah, I am a tireless campaigner for the rights of Iron Pies.
That's hilarious if you've ever worked with crystals. It's a crystal joke, is what I'm saying there. For an audience of maybe one.
Yeah, that's quite niche, actually.
I was going to say, when you're talking.
No one in prison will get that joke.
It depends.
The maps of their chi lines were banned.
It depends. I mean, when you're talking crystals, are we talking like a Breaking Bad thing or something like that?
No. Oh, I mean, I suppose it is, but I was more talking about crystals that naturally occur, like quartz.
I was going to say, according to Breaking Bad, those crystals naturally occur.
I'd be offering your primary source for quartz humour. So this is really mad, but as Uproxx noted when reporting on this, it is also basically a joke from Steven Soderbergh's Logan Lucky. Has anyone seen Logan Lucky?
Nope.
No, I don't know what the actual story is.
Is it on Netflix?
I don't know, maybe.
I'm sure I've seen it advertised when it pops up.
There is a scene in Logan Lucky where there's a prison riot and it ends up in a standoff between the prison guards and the prisoners. And the prisoners make a series of demands, and one of them is the Winds of Winter in the prison library. And the guards have to laboriously explain that he hasn't finished yet, which everyone thinks is so ridiculous that it must be a stalling tactic. If you are in jail in Maryland, do not attempt to read Game of Thrones, as it may be considered an escape tool.
Right, that's this week's public service announcement done. What's up next?
Rob, do you want to throw something in?
Yes, I will. I'll throw some Sean Spicer in there.
Nice. Martin and Spicer, the two amigos.
Yes. So, Sean Spicer has a new book. It's called The Briefing, Politics, the Press, and the President. And it's got a picture of Sean Spicer looking a bit more manly than he ever looked behind that podium.
Than he ever did on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not as manly on Saturday Night Live. Why is that?
He's not as manly in real life either. And basically, he describes Paul Manafort as impactful and describes the president as a unicorn riding a unicorn over a rainbow. Which, now, if you guys remember, I once said that the reason why Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un got on so well is because Donald Trump basically reminds Kim Jong-un of good old daddy, who also had rainbows at his birth as well, and unicorns and various other things. So maybe I was right.
I remember that, and I also remember you going on a very dubious tangent in the last episode
about unicorns
having sinister designs on virgins.
Well, I was questioning, why is it only female virgins? Why not male virgins? They're a thing as well. you know?
It's
yeah, as the whole incel movement will confirm.
Yeah, exactly. But all I'm saying is it's revisionist history, you know, it's revisionist fairy history, that's all. You know?
Revisionist fairy history, wow. Yeah.
I am stuck on this image of someone typing on 4chan going, oh, why is it that men have to pay all of the meal on a date? I mean, not like I've ever done that, but I've heard it's just getting rammed through by a unicorn's horn.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Unicorns are big horses with spikes.
But does the unicorn emerge from the computer?
I don't know.
I'm picturing it sort of charging up from behind.
Maybe it's in the bush with Sean Spicer.
Maybe.
It's like some weird commando thing going on. They just poke it. All you see is the eyes through the leaves.
A unicorn riding a unicorn over a rainbow.
Yeah.
Surely a unicorn riding another unicorn is just an inefficient mode of transport. Because no, that of the unicorn is just going to be weighed down by the first unicorn, so if anything it's going to go slower than the two unicorns walking side by side.
That's not true, Andrew. Remember when I had to give me a piggyback from Middlesbrough to Stockton and we actually made pretty good ground?
I don't know. I think, like, I agree with Andrew, like he says, you've got two horses, and it's allegedly 2 horsepower, but it's really only 1 horsepower. A 1 unicorn power.
Also, I'm not saying I can outrun a unicorn, but...
Well, which of us can?
Yeah.
It's quite a conundrum.
This book by Sean Spicer, it talks a lot about Paul Manafort, and it talks a lot about his time at the White House, but the overriding thing that that apparently you pick up from this is that he somehow still believes that he's in Donald Trump's good books.
What, Spicer?
Yeah.
Remember when the Pope visited America and Donald Trump just sort of gave Sean Spicer some, like, not even jobs to do, just said, no, you've got to stay back and just do nothing rather than go to meet the Pope. I didn't interpret that at the time as a show of great respect for Spicer, but maybe I'm wrong.
In the book, you find out what's happening behind the scenes when Spicer, now an unpaid Fox News guest with a podcast and an Instagram, which he didn't have before, he attacked the press for pointing out the small size of Trump's Inauguration Day crowd. What happened when he first saw Melissa McCarthy's impression of him on Saturday Night Live? What happened when Spicer denied that Adolf Hitler used chemical weapons? What happened when Anthony Scaramucci was appointed as Spicer's boss? What happened when Spicer was excluded from a papal visit? What happened when Spicer allegedly hid in the White House bushes on the night of James Comey's firing? Which, according to Spicer, didn't happen, but according to everyone else, absolutely did. And what happened when Trump's Access Hollywood tape emerged? You know that grab them by the... Thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
According to Spicer, a surprising number of women contacted him afterwards and said they didn't think Trump's comments were a big deal and said, you all talk like this, we know it.
And those women were Kellyanne Conway, Sarah Huckabee-Sanders.
Well, they were. One of them was definitely a prominent Republican woman.
Imagine my shock.
Well, we say woman. So, Spicy's book sounds like it could be worth a read, I'll be honest.
I've got to admit, when you were going through that list, I was struck by just how much of this mad stuff I'd forgotten about. Like, in any other White House, the fact that they had made a statement that Hitler never used chemical weapons would be a big embarrassment. It's like Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, it suddenly struck me while I was going through that list that it definitely feels like Trump's White House is modelled on... You remember the old political show we used to have, Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister? It feels like the entirety of the Trump White House has been modelled on Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister.
Yes, except without the dignity.
Exactly.
I mean, in a sense, it's almost a great strategy to say that no one will be able to take us up on this awful and ridiculous thing we've done when they're already distracted by the next awful and ridiculous thing.
Do you think it's like the Daily Mail where they have this, where they have that tube map of stories? They're like, okay, so Tuesday we're going to do this ridiculous thing to distract people from this particular story over here.
Yeah, possibly, actually. The thing about Spicer, too, I think people found him more sympathetic because he was so obviously set up as the sacrificial lamb for all this. It's like...
People just wanted to give him a hug. He looked so out of his depth.
And just any time something particularly terrible happened, they'd clearly just briefed him, all right, Sean, just go out there and say something dumb.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who just stands there and just denies everything.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders looks like she's having about as much fun giving those press conferences as I am watching them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look up plausible deniability, does it just have a picture of her behind a podium?
Yes. That's pretty wild, isn't it? What former Trump administration staffers have yet to write a book?
Scaramucci?
Oh, yeah, the Mooch, yeah. He's got one.
He just looks like somebody off Goodfellas, so that'll be interesting. And this is how we slice garlic in prison.
Thing is,
I just want him to finally confirm whether he can or cannot do the Fandango.
Maybe he'll learn in prison. You never know.
Scaramucci's ghostwriter would absolutely be Bret Easton Ellis, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
You can just picture him opening it with a long discussion on how great Huey Lewis and the News are.
Thing is, Sarah's right. He does sound like he was a character in Goodfellas.
He acted a bit like it as well.
So you come into my house.
I thought the day he got fired, I just thought, he's not been fired, he's just being made tonight.
I've just realised, think about it. Do you remember Marlon Brando in The Godfather? Now remember that image, and now overlap it with the current look of Donald Trump and just kind of merge the two together. And they do kind of work, don't they? So maybe...
Oh my God.
It's the jutting chin, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the sort of protruding lower lip. It's got a Mussolini sort of feel to it as well.
Well, it's kind of a pet lip, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe that's why the Mooch was hired in the first place. Maybe he is a made man.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe Donald appreciated Scaramucci making all those little problems back in New York go away.
Does that mean Spicy is kind of, you know, the kid who, the kid of his cousin's wife, you know, he can't get a job anywhere else, so he's just thrown him a bone?
Well, I think the problem is that Spicy's living in an entirely different movie genre. He is the guy at the start of the horror movie who just thinks, oh, I'm sure that loud thumping sound in the basement is nothing. Oh, well, back to bed.
Spicer reminds me more of the kind of crusty Dean from a bad 80s teen comedy. Oh, we've got to play some pranks on old man Spicer.
Maybe that's where he got the image of the unicorn from. Somebody just brought a unicorn into his office and left it there.
Either that or he's watching far too much My Little Pony Friendship is Magic in the hopes that maybe Trump would love him.
I absolutely guarantee you that the current White House watches loads of My Little Pony Friendship is Magic.
What you expect? It's the only thing that Donald Trump Jr. It's the only show for him.
Shall we move over to the last inhabitant of the White House?
Go on then.
As indeed most of the world wishes we could. Barack Obama and Joe Biden fight crime.
This sounds like the most amazing version of Batman and Robin.
Sadly, not in reality. This is in Andrew Schaefer's Hope Never Dies, narrated...
Oh, right. It's not just a statement.
No. It's narrated, apparently, by a John Watson-esque Biden looking for something to do after the 2016 presidential election. I quote from this Guardian article, his former vice president is scrolling through old text messages they sent each other, feeling left behind as he watches paparazzi videos of the 44th president kayaking with Justin Trudeau and base jumping with Bradley Cooper. However, they get back together to solve both the mystery of the death of Biden's favourite Amtrak conductor and a conspiracy surrounding the opioid epidemic.
Biden's favourite Amtrak conductor.
That's so sweet, though. Yeah. It's like old-style Agatha Christie, something's happened to the lady in the local cafe. Yeah. It brings it down to that level. But then you've also got, like, a big scene of opioid epidemics. I quite like that, big and small.
It kind of describes Biden to a T as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, you can absolutely picture Biden having a favourite Amtrak conductor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The book's editor, Jason Rekulak, says, it's a tiny bit ridiculous, but is it any more ridiculous than the real-life political events of last year? Which, yes, fair point.
I nailed it, yeah.
Now, it's quite strange, really. There hasn't been much Obama-related fiction compared to how sort of omnipresent previous presidents like JFK, Nixon, even Clinton to some extent were in fiction during their time in office.
Well, no, there was that... wasn't there a comic book about Barack Obama being some kind of Conan the Barbarian-type character, Andrew?
I'm pretty sure that... Yeah, I was just thinking that I'm sure I've remembered something like that.
Not to mention several less well-known videotapes.
Yeah. But, Barak the Barbarian, it was called.
So there's quite a lot to live up to here. Apparently, Schaefer came up with the idea the first time he saw Biden in aviator shades.
Yeah, that spawned a lot of memes, that picture.
It's sort of like, remember when there was that picture going around years ago of Putin putting on a pair of sunglasses and someone just captioned it, "Leave Bond to me."
Or the one of Putin riding, what was he riding?
Riding a unicorn.
He was riding something and then people just cut that out and put him on like a Ritz cracker, an eagle, a bear, a tree, you know, Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yes, I remember the Ritz cracker because it did have the caption "Putin on the Ritz."
Yes, classic. There were a lot of memes of Obama and Biden when they were in office and that sort of sweet relationship.
Do you think maybe that's part of it? Do you think like the memes have took the place of actual fictional representations of the president now?
I think it's a snappy access point, yeah.
If you're trying to insist that made-up representations of a current or former president could in any way like shape our opinion of that person and maybe make us end up, well, I say us, them, end up voting for a horrible, horrible person, I've no idea where you're coming from.
Sarah, do you want to tell us about what Manchester University students, not Manchester United students...
It'd be cool if it was Manchester United doing this, but no. So this is a story that is from The Guardian, and during a redecoration of the Student Union building, there had been put up a poster of "If" by Rudyard Kipling, which is a nice, inspiring poem.
Yeah.
But the students sort of took against it because of Kipling's life and other reputation as being a racist.
He was a horrible, horrible racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of, I think particularly they point to one of his poems. Let me just find what it's called. The White Man's Burden. Yeah, written in 1899. And they thought it was unacceptable to be put up in the Steve Biko building.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So they took matters into their own hands and painted over it. And now it's been replaced by Maya Angelou's Still Our Eyes, which is obviously an excellent choice. I'm so proud of them. I feel like I completely agree with them about Kipling. And I know Kipling has a great status as a poet and so on. But at the same time, he's just very much a product of that era. He's extremely old fashioned and has that horrible, bigoted, jingoistic reputation, which just doesn't apply nowadays. And the atmosphere of Manchester University is much more progressive than that. And the administration has admitted that they've made a mistake, and they're quite happy for the students to have replaced it.
What I find kind of incredible is that I have said many times, often on this show, that I think the current sort of fuss about free speech on university campuses is a moral panic, in the same way that, you know, the campaigns against rave culture in the 90s were a moral panic, the campaigns about mods and rockers were a moral panic.
Well, I think it's very much defined by, I want to say whatever I want, and I don't want people to tell me I'm a racist just because I'm being racist.
Yeah.
And that's one of my damning indictment of rave culture.
One of the websites that really pushes this spiked online is a horrible cavern full of goblins who got their start denying Balkan genocide. And now mark down any university with any sort of anti-bullying or anti-harassment policy as being against free speech. And they have been mad over this vitally important story. And if anyone doubts me that this is a moral panic, consider the fact that at this moment in British history, at a time when, you know, stuff's going down in this country, every news organisation has made a big thing about the students' union redecorating.
I have one question.
Mm.
You know when they're talking about free speech, right?
Yeah.
Do they fully understand that free speech is basically something that is political rather than personal, and that the right to free speech also means the right to bear the consequences of free speech?
Mm.
I mean, the charitable answer would be no, they need educating on that. The correct answer would be yes, they're just pretending they don't understand it.
So in their world, somebody would have the right to say racist things to me, for example, for being a brown person. But they would also have the right to bear the consequences of me breaking their nose for saying those things to me.
I would say that you should try and break their jaw, but I have seen pictures of Spiked Online's writing staff, and the chin fairy did not visit them.
Oh,
what a shocker.
Oh, are they all chinless wonders?
They are all kind of products of 17th century inbreeding by the looks of things.
Are they all storks? They're just you know what I mean by that?
yes I do.
That's how I describe them now. They're all storks.
So I think if people are going to have a ridiculous tantrum over this anyway, why stop at Maya Angelou? Why not put up something that's going to really annoy the people? Just some Kendrick Lamar or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That'd be nice.
Let's just go the whole hog. Let's just have Kanye kissing Kanye. Let's just bring that back.
You see, given recent form, they might be quite for that.
I think they maybe steer them in the direction of Kendrick more than Kanye.
Ah, it's Kanye kissing Kanye. It covers a lot of bases there.
Maybe we should just make it law that every university has to be decorated with erotic fan art.
No, because then there's that picture of Trump. Nobody needs to see that. Nobody needs that in their life.
You see, I'm laughing, but I can think of literally about 12 pictures of Trump that I would rather not have seen, most of which I have seen as a result of this show.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want, I can bounce it out by sharing a story of R2-D2 exploring Optimus Prime's butt. It contains a special room where he has pictures of all his close friends. I want to point out that in a very rare turn of form, this is not some weird thing I'm just making up off the top of my head.
Does it explain why his trailer keeps vanishing?
No. God, I wish it did.
Well, isn't his trailer kind of like his wife that he takes everywhere with him?
As soon as things get a bit, you know, boys together, it just rides off. No one knows where it goes.
It's probably having an affair with Jazz.
Oh, well.
Actually, I do really like just the image that, like, out of scene in every Transformers episode, there's just a trail, like, careening down the road, crashing through houses.
I quite like the idea that during every battle in Transformers, there's, like, Optimus Prime's disapproving wife just standing slightly off-screen.
Maybe that's...
and wondering when these boys are going to stop being so silly.
Oh, maybe that's what started the war. Maybe Prime and Megatron were after the same female Transformer. And Prime won it, and Megatron now is basically started a war out of jealousy and to prove how much of a better robot he is than Optimus Prime, so he can try and win her back. Maybe that's the saga. That's
Prime the truth. Would be standing there going, look, I'm a truck, she's a trailer. I mean...
Does that make him a different class?
Well, no, because this was, you know, it's a Japanese thing that was taken to America, and you can say, I'm a truck. She's a trailer. We obviously belong together, but then Megatron can turn around and say, well, I'm a gun and she's a trailer. And so obviously we belong together as well.
I suppose it is quite gender essentialist to say that a truck robot must always go out with a trailer robot.
I was thinking more American Trailer Park.
just to sort of...
standing off to one side, hoping that one day Megatron's going to realise it. Maybe the right person was standing just off to the left, planning his demise all along. All along.
I'm just going to gently drag you back to the story. I know. Because we've had other academics being the odd academic being a bit up in arms about the... the redecoration of Kipling's poem. Janet Montefiore, who's at the University of Kent, said that students should have been consulted, but that the painting over the poem was a bit OTT. I mean, I don't agree with her anyway. She said, of course he was a racist. Of course he was an imperialist, but that's not all he was. And it seems to me a pity to say so. Isn't that like saying that, well, I mean, of course Hitler annihilated a couple of people, but let's not forget he was a so-so painter.
Yeah, he was a mediocre painter as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, he was very caring for animals in that he was vegetarian.
I mean, I sort of have a dog in both of these fights because I am a huge, huge fan of Philip Larkin, who I think is perhaps the greatest poet Britain ever produced and who was a really unpleasant racist. But if someone said, perhaps we will not put up this 200-foot sculpture of Philip Larkin's This Be the Verse in a public place, perhaps we shall replace it with a poem by someone who isn't awful, I would not care.
This happens frequently. There's somebody who is fantastic at one thing, but then there's the dark side to them as well. And, you do feel conflicted. Like, you know, Michael Jackson, just the most amazing musician. Mm-hmm. But then sort of tie that in with the abuse allegations that he received. And
yeah.
How do you set your mind to that? How do you get your head around that?
I basically
I think it's tough because I'll throw my hand in the ring as a big H.P. Lovecraft fan.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, yeah, that is a tricky one.
And there's just, I think there's kind of no right answer, really.
Yeah, because it's just about what people can personally overlook and what people can personally accept. And it seems really weird to me to sort of preach to people that they should always accept something that makes them uncomfortable if they don't want to.
Mm. I just generally...
I mean, the whole thing with calling something like a problematic favourite is that people are going to have problems with it, and you should probably just accept that, yes, those complaints are very much valid.
Mm. And as time goes on, acceptability changes.
Yeah.
And people sort of naturally fade into history, maybe.
That's... basically,
but I mean, some of the academics were sort of saying, oh, well, does that mean you're not going to read Dickens? Because he was a massive racist as well. And that's obviously not what people are saying.
No, I mean, I just treat
let's not deny that aspect to his character.
Yeah.
I just treat one piece of art the same as any other piece of art. I don't bother with who's created it. If I see something being replaced by something else, I'll just appreciate the new thing as much as I appreciate the old thing.
Yeah, it's like Vincent van Gogh was a quality painter, but let's not forget he was a massive anti-earist.
Yeah, he hated ears.
He hated ears.
He was a demon in the cornfields.
Yeah. Much like Theresa May.
No, she was the wheat fields. She couldn't handle wheat being fields. Battered by the corn. And then there were the children in the corn, and they hounded her. You know?
Well, they would, wouldn't they? They were under 30s voices.
Kept chasing around the corn with their sides.
Is that what Theresa May's doing? She's hoping that if she annoys enough people, eventually some kind of omnipotent child is just going to send her to a cornfield.
That was kind of reminding me of something kind of a bit biblical. Like it was important. Sorry, I'm just thinking aloud. Please ignore that.
That's okay. The Twilight Zone is a holy text for some of us.
Yes, yes, it is. You know that MI6 place?
Well,
no, it's secret.
Yeah, I don't, because who does?
Well, over at that MI6 place that nobody seems to know about, because it's a secret British intelligence thing that has a massive building.
Yes. In movies.
Yes. Well, apparently over at the MI6 thing, they basically decided to take a leaf out of Anthony Horowitz's Alex Rider books and start training children to be undercover spies.
Right. This is the kind of initiative that people normally think is quite bad when, say, African countries in the middle of a civil war do it.
Yes. Mm. I mean, the first thing that I thought was, isn't that, like, just awful stories to choose as your inspiration for a new project for spies in the first place?
Yeah, I feel like maybe Codename May Youth isn't the best.
And secondly, if they're being trained as spies, are we talking like current James Bond type spies where they'll actually have licenses to kill and stuff as well? Or are they just going to be like spies as in, I don't know, one of those kids gang type things where they just stand in the corner and keep quiet so nobody notices them while their parents talk around them?
I mean, I just hope they're going to run around with ice creams with like comically large microphones sticking out of them.
Oh, it'll be quite hard for kids to be spies nowadays because everyone knows the main feature of spycraft is cutting eye holes in a newspaper. Yes. And no one under 50 reads a newspaper anymore.
I mean, are the kids who are getting involved in this project, have they read the Alex Rider books? Are they going in thinking that they're going to be stopping deadly computer viruses and, you know...
And how are they meant to pursue the people that they're spying on? I mean, pedal cars don't go that quickly.
All the kids are under the age of 18, but it doesn't actually specify how young. I mean, a toddler's not really going to make a good spy.
I think you touch on an important point earlier on, which is that the Alex Rider stories are rubbish.
Yes.
I have not had the pleasure of reading them, but I did see Stormbreaker, the movie they made based on it, in which Alex Rider is just the most insufferable little shit. And British intelligence in Stormbreaker, I swear to God, you can get into their secret headquarters by going into a photo booth and taking a photo, and it sets off the secret lift hidden in the photo booth.
Doesn't like, that then make British intelligence an oxymoron?
Well, yes. It's like they watched that episode of The Simpsons with Fidel Castro and thought, yeah, that's what it needs to be like.
My favourite Simpsons episode is the one with the $1 trillion bill where they go to
that's
Cuba.
The one. That's the
oh,
one.
Is that the one?
That's the one.
All right.
You will remember that the CIA agent gets like the microphone.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, by going into a photo booth and saying, say cheese. And the joke is that this makes it incredibly insecure, but here is Anthony Horowitz trying to do it seriously.
So, yeah, British intelligence, hiring kids. Thing is, it's MI6. They're based in London. So I'm assuming that most of the kids that they're going to hire are from London.
Yeah.
Which probably means that they're if they're doing their usual thing, then most of the kids that they hire aren't going to be schooled at, say, Harrow or Eton or anywhere like that. They're going to be going to, like, Hackney School for, I don't know, Dangerous Boys or something like that.
Do you think?
Oh, I've been there.
I'm just imagining... genuinely going for a toffs only policy on this. I mean, it's what they do, isn't it?
Well, it used to be what they do, but did you not see they were advertising a few years ago? It was in like loads
yes.
of papers.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They
were trying to open it up and not just have it from people who used to go to Eton and Oxbridge.
The reason being people around the world, you know, governments around the world started distrusting anybody with a posh accent. So, hello, how are you? Are you a spy?
What? No, I'm from Moscow, like you.
Hello, where Geordie's?
Yeah, I was great you saying that, like, oi, I'm Russian in it, bruv.
See, that's what I want now.
God, wouldn't Danny Dyer be amazing as the next James Bond?
There's an opening, I think.
There is, I suppose, a prominent former MI6 agent from our neck of the woods, isn't there?
Is there?
Yeah. David Shaler is from Middlesbrough.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Oh, who's David Shaler?
Well, David Shaler was an MI6 agent who leaked information about a plot to kill Muammar Gaddafi back in the late 90s and later resurfaced claiming that he was the son of God and also
Whoa.
Wanted to be called Dolores.
Wasn't there a film, what was that? It was Grimsby, wasn't it? The Sacha Baron Cohen movie.
Grimsby?
Yes.
Yeah, they are basically, they are not just taking their lessons on spycraft from Stormbreaker, they are taking them from Grimsby.
Yeah. Oh, the Brothers Grimsby, I suppose it was called, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, because nobody had a clue what Grimsby meant in the States. I could sort of told them that that was going to limit their audience from the start, but hey yo.
So, what's next, Ren?
Should we talk about some poisoned books?
Got
yeah.
It.
Let's do that.
What, again?
That could be a good lead-in for Andrew. We don't know.
Yes. Three rare books on various historical topics in the library of the University of Southern Denmark contain large concentrations of arsenic on their covers.
Who are these books for?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I'm reading this article by Jacob Povel Holk and Kari Lund Rasmussen, two professors at the University of Southern Denmark. And they claim that they have discovered this, and they give a lot of detail about how it was discovered and what arsenic is, which I think is not, you know, it's nice to be complete, I guess. But they don't say which books.
Ah.
Which makes me wonder, did they put it on the books? Are they trying to sort of deflect scrutiny by publishing this article while also keeping the deadly books in circulation?
Mm. I mean, is there like some kind of diplomat famous for their love of licking books?
Well, if you hark back to the Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, the people would read these books, and the books were a little bit forbidden, and they weren't for everybody. And they'd lick their finger to turn the page and die of the resulting poison.
Yeah, because they had green fingers, didn't they? Because the arsenic.
At the end of John Webster's play, the Duchess of Malfi, a woman is killed by being made to kiss a poisoned Bible.
Oh, yeah.
What are these books about?
That's the thing. Nobody knows what books they are.
So
I can't remember the one in The Name of the Rose.
So there's three mysterious books that have poisoned covers and nobody knows which ones they are.
All it says is that they are on various historical topics.
Well, I think
which covers everything in the past.
Yeah.
So is this just done by somebody who hates history in general?
<That's>... Down.
Oh, it's Aristotle's Poetics that was poisoned in Name of the Rose.
Right.
So why would that be verboten?
Wasn't Aristotle like that after his death there was a sort of sex manual that went around and it's published as Aristotle's Complete Masterpiece? It wasn't by Aristotle, it was just like giving it a sheen of respectability. Maybe that was something to do with this. I can't remember.
You know, Aristotle wasn't his real name.
Don't shatter all my illusions.
No, seriously, I had this explained to me. Socrates apparently wasn't his real name. His name was something else, but Socrates was kind of his title, which means something else in ancient Greek. But then Plato, for example, Plato wasn't his real name because Plato, being Socrates' student, according to Socrates, Plato had a flat head like a plateau. That's why he gave him the name Plato.
I've heard that. Yeah.
But then with Aristotle being Plato's student, Aristotle was obviously from day one, he was obviously much, much smarter than Plato and apparently was forever correcting him. So Plato called him Aristotle, which basically means smart ass or brainiac.
Wow, they had the word brainiac in ancient Greece.
Yeah, basically.
How come we don't have philosophers now who are called, like, Specky Four Eyes?
Oh, don't forget, though, we figured out the ancient Greek philosopher who lived in a barrel was basically a proto-Kevin Sorbo film critic.
Was that, who is that? I can't remember the name of the guy. Daedalus? No. Demetrio? No. Some beginning with D. The barrel guy? Can't remember.
Google the barrel guy.
The barrel guy. Okay, I'm on Google. Barrel guy.
AC Grayling, or as I call him, Foofy Hair.
There's the barrel man with the Denver Broncos.
What if?
Diogenes.
Yeah, Diogenes,
What if, guys, Noam Chomsky just steals people's food?
So Aristotle's sex book was fake news then?
It was, yes, yeah.
Is that as in the book was fake or that it wasn't written by Aristotle?
It was not written by Aristotle. The book itself existed and was very popular in the like pre-Victorian era, but Aristotle's Complete Masterpiece was not by Aristotle.
Hmm. So anything else? Or shall we hand over to Andrew?
Let's hand over to Andrew.
Let's hand over to Andrew.
I will immediately drop everything on the floor. But no, we are with me. Because I done gone read one of them books.
Oh,
say
wow.
What? Looks like we got ourselves a reader.
Is this? Are we doing the Bill Hicks sketch? Please say, yeah. What you reading for?
What you reading for?
So I don't become a waffle waitress. I always love that sketch. Not what you're reading, but what you're reading for.
Yeah.
So yes, what is an amazingly rare occurrence on our literary based podcast? I have a book to review. It is The Synapse Sequence by Daniel Godfrey, who was last on this show when I was talking about New Pompeii.
Ooh, you quite liked that as well.
Yeah, I did. I rather enjoyed it. It was some good fun. So this is another science fiction book. It is set in London in the near future, where most of the jobs are now automated and the majority of the population lives on a kind of a universal job seekers allowance type thing.
Like a basic salary handed out by government.
Yeah, basically a government handout so they can afford to live and eat and not die and stuff.
Do they have to wait 6 weeks before they get their first payment?
Strangely, that's not brought up. Anyway, that's also weirdly, like, not and also kind of is the point of the book. Going alongside this is the story of Anna Glover, a woman who works with a brand new device called the Synapse Sequencer, which is an experimental bit of software designed to allow you to see the memories of anyone hooked up to it.
Blimey.
And she gets drafted in to use that to dive into the mind of a teenager in a coma so they can find out what has happened to his kidnapped foster sister.
Okay.
One of the comparisons that gets drawn on the blurb. And also, side note, God, I hate when, like, people's reviews say things like, it reads like Philip K. Dick or Black Mirror. You know, those popular things. But I think one of the genuinely quite good comparisons it makes is to Michael Crichton.
Mm.
And this does read a lot like this, where it's a fun mystery novel. And it's kind of, it's lots of twists and turns. Mm. It's kind of got a fun setup where they can only read the guy in the coma whose name is N'Golo Durant. They can only read his mind so many times before the stress of it will completely fry his brain and he'll die. Right. So that kind of, it's kind of, you know, it's a fun bit of tension of, you know, each one of these has got to be important, but also we can't really choose what this guy is remembering.
Mm.
But similar to Michael Crichton, I think this book sort of falls apart if you spend, like, more than 3 seconds trying to think about any of the science fiction or social setup.
Right.
Because going back to this idea of, like, you know, the entire world, all the jobs are run by robots now. It's one of those things I can't help thinking, but, like, how did you let things get like this? Because every scene seems to be about, gosh, isn't it bad that no humans have jobs anymore? And also the robots aren't that great at, like, customer-facing jobs. But
I don't
also
know, it sounds like we're already about halfway to this situation, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I feel like there's very specifically, like, shops hiring humans to work on tills. Because people don't. Because people would rather talk to a person than use the automated things. It's just, it seems a bit weird that you'd get, like, years and years into this system of everyone hates talking to robots, but we still have to talk to the robots.
What if the inventor of it was, like, really charismatic and said wacky things on Twitter, but did not call a child rescuing hero a paedophile, so people had no reason to turn against him?
God, that's, you know, fine. I'll accept that as the canon explanation of how this happened. But similarly, trying to tie this into real world events, there's also a bunch of stuff worth revealed that maybe the government is involved in some kind of shadowy conspiracy. And I just feel you can't have that kind of story anymore, because I read that and then I look at the news and the politicians tripping over their own feet trying to organise some kind of Brexit. It's like,
There's no shadow of conspiracy.
Andrew, is there a in this book a facility for erasing memories as well? I mean, if does it explore like memories that if people aren't happy with it, can they just erase them or can they change them or what happens there? Are they just left alone, just observed?
See, it doesn't, and that's the kind of thing I would have liked it to go into a bit. Mm. And I feel like it maybe could have, if it had picked, you know, one or two, they either be about like a future society where robots have most of the jobs, or a future society in which we've developed the technology to see into people's minds.
Mm.
Mm.
But a lot of it, it's more based in the very early stages of just, we can just about see what things people are thinking of.
I think that's not, like Graham was saying, I don't think that's that far away. And it part of it is already here anyway. I mean, my tablet overhears me chatting about, I don't know, Rolos or something, and then I get non-stop Rolo adverts for the next month. But also, I don't even have to say it out loud. Sometimes I'm just thinking it, which is a bit worrying, because I do think a lot about Rolos.
That's terrifying.
There's a bit of stuff about like the idea of memories that I quite like, because there's plenty of things where it does. I like that it avoids the common trope of looking at someone's memory is basically the same as looking at a photo. And if you just think hard, you can zoom and enhance.
Oh, yeah.
So,
you can create sort of a version of what that person was thinking about. But anything that they weren't actively thinking about at the time is going to be very fuzzy and blurry.
Yeah.
And also, it's very easily subject to change because memory isn't perfect.
So I've got to ask, how does this compare with the likes of, say, Total Recall or Eternal
Minority
Sunshine?
Minority Report,
or even something like Paprika?
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's definitely like kind of in that same kind of vein, but I think it struggles because it is quite unfocused.
Yeah.
Just like memories, eh?
Mm. Yeah.
It also does some structural stuff that I don't like. Because lot of the framing is, there's chapters set in sort of the present, which is also sort of the future, where they're trying to solve this mystery. And also even further in the future, where Anna is now in a retirement home, talking to a journalist about one of her weird background things, which is that she was an airplane crash investigator. But one of the crashes she investigated was used by the government to start a war, but also everyone blames her for that, which just seems kind of weird and a bit nonsensical.
It sounds tangled.
Yeah, it's quite awkward because the chapters also aren't very long, so you're always jumping between the two, and it can be hard to both follow the threads and also see what the point of that even further in the future thing is for quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you've read any kind of, or seen Total Recall or Paprika or anything like that, you can probably guess what the big twist with that stuff is.
Yeah.
That being said, though, it does have another twist at the end that I didn't see coming and thought was very well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think as a mystery novel, it's a fun read.
Mm.
Just as a bit of speculative fiction, it's a bit tangled and doesn't really say anything.
Mm.
Except, gosh, wouldn't it be bad? What if all the robots took the jobs? So I guess in a way, it is like Black Mirror.
I think that the notion of a basic salary has been under consideration by the government following a Scandinavian model, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been piloted in Finland, I think, universal basic income.
Mm.
Yeah, I think Daniel Godfrey, he's taken that idea from things that are happening now. But he's kind of, he's blown it up to such a proportion. But I suppose it's not even that it's unbelievable that it could happen, that all the robots have the jobs and none of the people do. It's just the book doesn't really do enough work to sell me on that idea.
Yeah.
It just says, you know, this is how things are, and here's a long list of problems with that.
Yes.
So obviously my immediate thought is just, but if it's got all these problems, why are people doing it?
Yeah, there would have been some kind of societal pushback against the robots taking all the jobs, wouldn't there?
Excuse me, no. Society doesn't do any of that. All we do is rage about it on Twitter, witness Donald Trump and his Timothy Leary Etch-a-Sketch presidency.
He's got a point.
I was going to say, I detected a little bit of rage leaking out there.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I really shouldn't get so angry about these things. But I don't...
This is going to, but think, speaking of things with a point, that this book has one thing that I genuinely really hate and think is very, very, very bad.
Mm.
Right.
Anna Glover's quite a bland protagonist, and I feel like Donald Godfrey was aware of that. So he's tried to give her this thing about how she sometimes cuts herself to relieve stress as like a
character
quirk. And yeah, it's very bad.
And why?
No, Daniel Godfrey, you can't use a thing that is like a genuine psychological problem and something people struggle with for their entire lives as just a look at this weird thing this character does. Isn't she so deep and cool?
It does remind me slightly of that tick that American movies and TV shows have developed when they want to show that their cop or whoever their protagonist is on the edge, and they just pour out like a fistful of medication and just neck it all as though it was Skittles.
Then when
they want to go off, then they just flush it all down the toilet and there's absolutely no side effects.
Everyone knows the more medicine you take, the better you feel.
Oh, the more varied medicine you take. Not just the more medicine, but you have to take multiple types of medicine all at once. And you never check, you know that little information slip you get? You never check that to see if the medicine you're taking reacts with any other medication that you're taking, just in case you have an adverse reaction or it causes some kind of severe allergic reaction, in which case you might die or end up hospitalized for the next few months. That never happens.
Well, no, to be fair, they do point out that the best way to take medicine is to take it with a drink.
Oh, alcohol,
of course, being like a double shot of whiskey.
Yeah. Which seems to be different measurements in America. I mean, we know what a double shot is, but for them it seems to be half a bottle.
Yes. Well, is that about a week, do we think?
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yes.
Hmm.
That's us for this week. We'll be back in a fortnight. Again, welcome, Sarah.
Hey, thanks, man. It was cool.
Awesome. What was the book called again, Andrew?
That is called The Synapse Sequence by Daniel Godfrey.
That's all from us then for this week. We'll be back in a fortnight. Until then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
I've been...
You two always do this.
And I've been Sarah. I guess.
Yes. We'll see you all.
And I've been Sarah.
Yeah, we'll see you all later.
Thanks for
and I've been Sarah. And I've been Sarah.